And we've got a very special guest. Why? Because we fight back on this show against policies that harm people. And again, I'll allow our guest to correct me if I'm wrong. I believe his name is Fafel. If that's wrong, I'll be corrected. Kaboob. But more important, Dr. Fafel Kaboob, assistant professor of economics at Denison University in Granville, Ohio, a place near and dear to my heart. In 1992, I ran against a man named John Kasich, and I lost everywhere in Licking County because they didn't include Newark because it was Democratic somewhat in the district. But I did win the commanding heights of Denison University and Granville, Ohio. An oasis of blue.
One of the loveliest counties in the country.
Gorgeous. He's also a research associate at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. Some of you have heard of that. The Levi Economics Institute of Bard College and the Center for Full Employment and Price Stability. Dr. Kaboob, welcome to Fight Back.
Thank you. Thank you, Bob.
And,
thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, and again, really, I saw your presentation the other day at the Forum on the Other America, the 50th anniversary of a dear friend of mine, really one of my political mentors who I worked with very closely for 10 years, Michael Harrington. And I thought your analysis of what we could actually do in America was stunningly brilliant, and I usually never use those words. You know, I'm jaded. I've been around, and what you want to take us through this history of poverty in America and what we could actually do about it. How did we get in this situation? And I may be wrong, but I was looking at a lot of the charts. My background, I have a PhD in political science, is that a lot of that stuff seemed to come out of the Reagan era, where the productivity of workers suddenly didn't matter anymore. Is that accurate?
Well, you're absolutely right, actually. A lot of the answers to the problems that we're facing today have their essentially root causes back all the way to the 1970s and 80s. It's not necessarily Reagan that was the turning point, but the Vietnam War, the stagflation of the 1970s were kind of the seed for that political transformation that happened both in the United States and England at the same time. When Reagan took office, Margaret Thatcher in England also took office. And they both came with a very neoliberal philosophy, which is what we know today as neoliberalism.
Which is really kind of old-fashioned, unregulated capitalism, where they really unleashed the multinationals on the population, so to speak.
Right. So that was a wave of deregulation at the national level, attack on labor unions, first an attack on private sector labor unions, and most recently on public sector labor unions, which is kind of the last, you know, shoe to drop in this neoliberal attack. Both Reagan and Thatcher deregulated the local economy, privatized a lot of the traditional state-owned companies national companies, and part of that was to break the companies into little units, break the unions, and unleash the free trade era. So it started in the 1970s, early 1970s. And the key thing to remember here is that since World War II, pretty much since 1945, 46, workers' productivity was growing hand in hand with wages. So the more productive workers became, the higher wages they received. So that was essentially allowing the workers' consumption to be the driving engine of the economy. And consumption is still the driving engine of the U.S. economy today. 70% of GDP is consumer spending. The difference, however, though, was that in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, and early 70s, all that consumption was fueled by actual income, wages, actual source of revenue. But since the 1970s, you start looking at that picture, and productivity continues to grow steadily on the same trend, but wages remain flat, pretty much flat for the last four decades. And that gap you would think would normally have a serious effect on consumption. So you would expect since the 1970s the share of consumption in GDP to drop because workers don't have that income to continue to fuel consumption. However, that was the moment when you start having massive deregulation in the financial system
mm-hmm.
leading up to the present. And the point of that deregulation was essentially to allow financial institutions to extend credit to workers, consumers, so that they continue to spend beyond their means. And that was, in a way, looking at it, 40 years later, in a way, from Wall Street perspective, that was genius. Because on the one hand, you don't have to increase bargaining power for workers. You don't have to increase income for middle-class families, lower-income families. And at the same time, you're burdening this entire group with debt, so you're putting them under your grip. You're putting them under control for a long time. And occasionally, you'll hear people like Alan Greenspan actually referring to this as a good thing. Alan Greenspan several times referred to this as something that kept inflation under control. The fact that workers were heavily burdened by debt actually reduced their bargaining power because they have so much to lose if they lose their job. So that was the turning point in U.S. history.
I have a question, by the way. This is Michael.
Hi, Michael.
Reagan famously broke the Air Flight Controllers Union during his time period in office. And it seems odd because it doesn't seem to me that it's really the president's place to be stepping into that, but he did it. He was successful in doing it. How did that impact the way things went and this unholy marriage, if you will, between himself and the Iron Lady, Margaret Thatcher?
Right. Well, it was a turning point again in history, the fact that a president can intervene and break a labor union, essentially, use the might of the United States military, so to speak.
And shackle their leadership literally hand and foot and drag them off to jail.
Right, literally. I mean, it explains itself. I mean, when you have the power of the federal government, the power of the security forces, essentially breaking the labor movement, that was meant to be a lesson for all the other labor unions, that this is the new United States of America, this is the new world. Same thing in England. And when you have the United States and England on the same page in terms of political philosophy and economic philosophy, the rest of the world must follow. And that's when you start seeing the power of the World Bank and the IMF turning the entire developing world into a neoliberal economic model with all the disastrous consequences that we've seen since the 1980s. That was essentially the turning point in recent history, in recent world history.
And in many ways, it's a return to the era of the robber barons, those, the railroad strike of 1877, where you called out the army and killed dozens of workers, the Pullman strike of 1894, the same Colorado mine wars from 1911 to 1916 or so, and even a lot of this going on in the 1930s when it was changed, literally. At one point, there were 6 million workers on strike during the Great Depression, which really forced the Wagner Act, which bought us a brief period, decades of at least some labor peace. Is that a correct analysis?
It is correct, but it wasn't just in the 1900s, early 1900s and late 1800s. It's still happening in 2011, 2012 with the Occupy movement. We've seen it. We have hundreds and thousands of young people peacefully protesting in New York and California, all over the country. And you've seen the vicious attack by the police in several occasions.
Oh, I was down there. I filmed it. I went down for when they reoccupied earlier this year, and I have never seen so many police. It looked like there were about 5 police for every demonstrator, and they looked like they were randomly pulling people in and beating them. Are you saying that's a deliberate, conscious decision?
Or pepper spraying them.
Yeah.
Or pepper spraying in California, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's a deliberate attack by the police. I'm saying that there's corporate interest of actually financing the police department in New York City, for example, with investment banks donating millions of dollars to the police force to protect their buildings.
I lived in Detroit,
right.
And you know, back in the 1930s, it was just taken for granted. The Dearborn Police were owned by Henry Ford, who, by the way, was one of the few people who actually thought he should pay his workers at least a decent wage. The Highland Park Police were owned by Chrysler, and the Detroit Police, everyone knew, were really controlled in many ways by General Motors in those days. So this is a return to kind of a almost a naked attempt to stifle dissent. And getting back, these financial instruments, they really cross class lines, right? You have these sort of rent-to-rob rental places, so the poor can briefly own high-def TVs. You've got these used to be called loan sharks, these check-cashing institutions that, you know, sometimes their interest over a year is over 3,000%. And then you have that weird scenario of NODOC, honor system, housing loans. Does all of that fit into this analysis that you're giving us with these financial instruments? Really appears to be a way to extract wealth from poor and working people.
Oh, absolutely. There's a whole plethora of financial innovations that were essentially designed specifically for that purpose, is to artificially create additional income for the working class so that they continue to spend, so that they don't have to worry about that gap between wage and productivity. But that artificial addition of income was, in fact, debt. When you're adding debt onto consumers, you have to be really creative to entice people into it, force them into it, and then use the rule of law to enforce it onto the population. I'll give you a few examples, and this starts early on, obviously, with the credit card boom in the 1980s. That would have been impossible if the usury laws, the state usury laws, remained in place. So there was a national movement to get rid of the usury laws, and if you remember where the credit card industry first kind of relocated from New York City to Sioux Falls, South Dakota.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that was the first state that removed the usury laws, which is the maximum interest that a financial institution could charge. But then there was a key Supreme Court decision in the mid-1980s. It's called the Marquette decision. And that decision essentially says that a financial institution would charge the interest rate of the state where the credit card decision was made. So if a financial institution relocates to Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and opens its credit card office there, and they receive the applications there from somebody from California, New York, Tennessee, Ohio, any other state, then it's the laws of South Dakota that apply, which means the maximum interest rate of South Dakota that applies. And that's why you see the entire Wall Street industry relocating to Sioux Falls, South Dakota in those early days, and the credit card instrument starts to take over the entire United States. And that was the first financial innovation, which required legal intervention, obviously, deregulation, to make that happen. And then after that, you start looking at all kinds of extension of credit in terms of mortgages and deregulation of the mortgage business, credit student debt, which is massive. I mean, when you talk to, I talked to my friends who, went to school in the United States in the 1960s, 70s, and early 80s, They didn't hear about students.
No, I lent them. We had grants.
Exactly.
Including National Defense.
I talked to my students, most of my students, and, student loans is the only thing that exists, with a little bit of grants here and there and scholarships here and there, but most of their access to education today is financed through student loans. And that wouldn't have been possible without, massive deregulation in the financial system. So here you see kind of the coordination between the financial institutions who are supposedly providing the solution for the middle class, right, and allowing the American dream to happen, and the federal government and the state and local governments who are, making these credit extensions possible, legally possible. And at the same time, as the state, as the government is disengaging itself from the welfare state, from supporting students, from supporting workers, from supporting middle-income families, from supporting the elderly, the state is being replaced by credit coming from financial institutions. And that's been building up for 40 years, and we're suffering the consequences today.
Okay, we're going to talk about those consequences after the break. We're here with Dr. Kaboob, who works at Denison University, an expert on poverty and debt and economics. We'll be right back on Fight Back.
You're listening to Fight Back. Dr. Bob will be back after these brief messages.
You have a truly special event coming up? Make it unforgettable with a chauffeured limousine from Cardinal Transportation. Central Ohio's premier chauffeured transportation company, Cardinal Transportation provides personalized, affordable, and safe transportation both locally or out of town. Their fleet includes a 1960 Rolls Royce, 8-passenger limos, and buses for up to 56 passengers. Contact Cardinal Transportation today at 274-2500, or online at cardinaltrans.com, or visit them on Facebook at Cardinal Transportation.
You gotta fight! Fight your right!
If you like to party, and who doesn't, you know that sometimes stuff happens. Stuff like assault, drugs, DUI. Connie Cadell Newton understands. She's not here to judge anyone, just to provide the best legal representation possible. Facing criminal charges? Connie takes very special care handling her criminal cases and works hard to ensure that her clients receive the very best results possible. Do you have a record? Connie is very familiar with the new expanded expungement statute. Got warrants? Connie may be able to keep you out of jail. Connie also handles domestic relations, mediation, and bankruptcy cases. Call Connie Cadell Newton at 307-9783. Connie welcomes clients from diverse communities, GLBT, African-American, activists, students, and more. So party on. Just remember, if you get this one phone call, make it to Connie Cadell Newton at 307-9783.
This is Connie Cadell Newton, and I will fight for your right to party.
Meat Packers Outlet, Columbus's good old-fashioned retail meat market. For the best deals around on all your meat purchases, visit Meat Packers Outlet at 317 South 5th Street downtown. Meat Packers Outlet is family-owned and operated and has proudly been serving Columbus with fresh-cut meat since 1957. Meat Packers Outlet has daily low prices on beef, pork, poultry, and deli items. This week's specials include deli sliced honey ham, just $2.99 a pound. Bar-S wing is 99 cents for a one-pound package. A 10-pound bag of fresh hamburger, just $19.90. And whole pork loins are $2.49 a pound. Need a deli tray for your next get-together? Call ahead and order yours now at 469-1720. That's 469-1720. Open 8 to 6, closed Sundays. Meat Packers Outlet, 317 South 5th Street at East Main, downtown. Don't forget, there's always plenty of free parking in the back. Locally owned, independently owned, Meat Packers Outlet. Call 469-1720. Meat Packers Outlet, Columbus's good old-fashioned retail.
You get anxious just thinking about going to the dentist? The Gentle Dentist in Worthington understands. Founded by Dr. Bill Coleman, the Gentle Dentist is dedicated to the care of the apprehensive dental patient and is committed to providing the highest quality dental care in a relaxed and enjoyable environment. The Gentle Dentist offers cable TV, DVD players, and massage chairs in every treatment room. They use the latest technology to give you that beautiful smile you deserve, including Invisalign, the virtually invisible way to straighten your teeth. The highest quality dental care in a relaxed and enjoyable environment. The Gentle Dentist, voted the number one dental office in Central Ohio by Columbus Parents Magazine 2 years in a row. Visit them in Worthington, just south of 270. Call today, 614-431-3311, or visit them online at ColemanDental.com. That's ColemanDental.com. Call today, 614-431-3311. The Gentle Dentist. Exceptional service, remarkably gentle.
He doesn't just play a doctor. Bob Petrakis is a doctor. Just not that kind of doctor.
back to Fight Back with political science professor Dr. Bob Petrakian.
All right, this is Dr. Bob Petrakian. We got a call already, and that number to call if you want to talk with Dr. Fahil Kaboob, who is assistant professor of economics at Denison and a research associate at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. Caller, is this Barbara? What's on your mind?
Yes, sir, Dr. Bob. Mm-hmm. I've noticed that for the last 30 years since student loans are keeping students in debt, they have no time to become activists or think for themselves because they're so worried about the debt they're creating and the education they need to succeed. So, and also, I also want to get both of your takes, and I'd like to say good morning to the professor, of what happened in the debate, Wednesday. What happened to Barack in the debate? Why did he not become more aggressive or with Romney's deny what Romney was saying, challenges his figures.
All right, Professor, could this been a deliberate plan? I have my own take on it, to keep students less active coming out of that 60s and 70s period of student activism and the debate. Those two questions to you, Professor.
Right, so the first question about student debt and was this a deliberate kind of conspiracy against the working class, against students, from the 1980s to transform the nature of U.S. society and world politics, I guess. My take on this is I tend to stay away from conspiracy theories, but I truly believe that Reagan and Thatcher and all the neoliberals of the 1980s and Milton Friedman and all the, you know, economists behind this thing and Friedrich Hayek, who was, you know, the favorite for Margaret Thatcher, they truly believed in the free market. They didn't see anything wrong with this. So that's my take on this.
Well, let me throw in one fact that I actually wrote on this area. There was a man named Jerry Falwell who created a group called The Moral Majority, and he actually wrote that one of his big pushes when Reagan took over, he argued that the campuses were liberal incubators for activism and that we should defund them by shifting money to a proper incubating institution, which he saw as the military. And one of the things that Reagan did, in fact, is shift a lot of money that went to education to the new army, that if you wanted to be all you could be and drive a laser-guided tank, you could get a grant by going into the National Guard or the military. So that looked like an actual fact. There was an attempt to shift the money to get students to go into the military prior to going to college.
Right, and this is where you see a political transformation turning into an entire social transformation that we're living in today. If you have the working class burdened by debt, if you have students burdened by debt, and they have to work multiple jobs and worry about making their payments, when are they going to have time to relax? When are they going to have time to organize or be active? And that's why we didn't see this Occupy movement emerge until the Great Recession, when it was clear for hundreds of thousands of young people who are mostly unemployed, well-educated, and have no access to jobs, no access to, you know, increasing their status in the social ladder. The only thing left is to occupy and protest. That's why we didn't see this in the 1990s, for example.
And what about your thoughts on the debate and the economic policy expressed there, particularly by the president?
I share the opinion of Barbara, I think, the person who asked the question, that President Obama was very weak, was defensive, looked even tired. I don't understand what was going on. He thought maybe that Romney would show up in the debate and say exactly the same things that he was saying for the last 12 months in the campaign. Romney was pretty smart. He was confident. He was very confident. He was very articulate. He was very clear about his message. But he did change his message. And for the average American citizen who didn't really follow the campaign over the last 12 months, they listened to Mitt Romney, and I'm pretty sure some people in the center and conservatives, they like him. They like him very much. And the president, again, was very weak. So he has to really come out and be a little bit more aggressive. Instead of saying, you know, Romney and I agree on this, Romney and I agree on this, he could have said, well, this is what Romney's plan is going to do to the economy, and this is what I propose. But he didn't come out and say that.
821-1580, how bad is the economy? And I'm not just talking about the official unemployment rate, but discouraged workers as well.
You're absolutely right. You're asking the right questions here. So the official unemployment rate, and it's worth explaining here how, you know, the BLS, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, arrives at those numbers or those calculations. They do a phone survey. So they're not actually surveying the entire population. It's not a census.
Mm-hmm.
And they ask people, have you actively been seeking work in the last 4 weeks? And that's a very technical statement there, actively seeking work, ASW, which means you're applying for jobs, you're turning in resumes, you're doing job interviews, you're looking at newspaper ads, you're actually trying to find a job in every possible way in the last 4 weeks. And the truth of the matter is that a lot of people have been doing this for a long time, since the beginning of this recession. And if you live in a rural area, if you live in, you know, in a small town in the Midwest, how many job openings will there be within, you know, the last 2 years? After a while, you've pretty much applied to all the possible jobs, you talk to all the companies, and after that, you're just sitting there and waiting. You're discouraged. That's the group that's actually excluded. So if you get the phone call from the BLS and they tell you, have you been actively seeking work in the last 4 weeks? You say, well, I've been actively seeking work in the last 2 years, 3 years, but the last 4 weeks, no, because I don't think there's anything new available in my town or in my area. And if you say that, you're excluded from the labor force. You're not unemployed. And that's how the unemployment rate has been dropping in the last few months. Not so much because we're creating a lot of jobs, but because a lot of people have been leaving the labor market and are becoming discouraged. The U.S. economy has to create at least 135,000 new jobs every month just to stay afloat, just to keep up with population growth and new people coming into the labor market. And we haven't been creating anything close to that, 90,000, 100,000, sometimes 80,000. So that's adding to the jobs deficit. So we're not even close to staying afloat. We're just seeing a lot of people being discouraged. So if you take into account those people who are being kicked out of the labor force because they're discouraged, and if you also take into account the people who are working part-time involuntarily, because when the BLS asks you that question, if you say, well, I worked 5 hours here, 3 hours there, but I really don't have any stable job in the last 4 weeks, they count you as employed. They count you as employed, so you're not unemployed, even though you're not making enough money to survive. And that's really the staggering number that we've seen in this Great Recession. And we haven't seen anything like this since the Great Depression. So right now, 40% of the unemployed are long-term unemployed. We haven't seen anything like this since the Great Depression. Even in the midst of the 1980s recession, the highest percentage of long-term unemployment was 25%. Now we're in the 40-45% range. That's urgency for job creation, and we haven't heard anything in the debates about that, about specifics, how you address these severe problems. The other key variable that's missing in the unemployment numbers is the part-time workers. We're looking at millions
of
people.
We used to call those underemployed, didn't we?
Well, if you add them up, if you take the officially unemployed, the part-time, you know, involuntary part-time workers, and the discouraged workers, then we call that the underemployment rate. And right now we're at close to 15%, 14.7, I think.
So that's more than double the official rate, or right around there?
It's actually always the case. The official unemployment rate, when you look at it compared to the underemployment rate, the number is almost always double. So we have to keep that in mind all the time, not just right now because of the Great Recession. So the economic reality for the middle class, for the working class, should be assessed based on the underemployment rate, not the unemployment rate. But unfortunately, the media always, you know, focuses on the official rates, and politicians only focus on the official unemployment rate, which is very misleading. And this is not to blame the BLS. Actually, you go to the BLS website, you read their press releases, they tell you all these numbers. They're not hiding it. It's just the media and citizens and politicians who pick on just the official numbers and decide to ignore millions of people who were excluded from the official statistics.
And what about the working poor? I mean, there's also a group of people out there that are being nickeled and dimed, right, and working full time, but it's not a living wage. Is that a problem as well?
Well, absolutely. I mean, we've seen this when you have a decline in labor unions. This is the result. You get millions of people who are being shifted from full time jobs with benefits to temp agencies, and this is a massive enterprise in the U.S. economy, and it's a growing enterprise, especially after the Great Recession. You see many manufacturing companies switching their employees from, you know, full time employment benefits to temp jobs, which is low-paying jobs, no benefits, and no unions, and no certainty in terms of employment day-to-day. We're not even talking month-to-month. We're talking about day-to-day employment is uncertain. And that doesn't help the middle class. That doesn't help the working class. So that's the working poor generation that we're seeing now dominating the U.S. labor market increasingly.
And they're doing, by the way, they're doing this, these companies are doing these things to increase their own bottom line, are they not?
Absolutely. I mean, why else would they do it? I mean, it's about profits. Lowering costs, and then, of course, when you put this in the context of globalization and free trade, which, again, goes back to the 1980s, the whole deregulation and free market thing, then they say, well, look, we live in a global economy. We can't compete. We have to do this. Otherwise, we're moving to China or moving to Mexico or moving to whatever. So that increases the pressure on labor unions, on the working class to accept, you know, to race to the bottom, to accept whatever corporations are offering. And they've been doing this for decades now.
821-1580. What? I'm an advocate of a Green New Deal. I mean, the government actually hiring workers to go out and do a variety of things that we need to do. Would it help if they actually fully funded, and I mean fully funded, the old Humphrey Hawkins bill, which made the government the employer of last resort? I mean, I was one of the last guys that went through CETA. I came out of college. I went over to CETA. They asked me where I wanted a job. I said I'd like to work in a record store. They actually paid for my management training. All of those programs have disappeared.
Right. I'm a big supporter of the New Deal, any program that has the federal government operate as the employer of last resort. And this is not, I mean, a lot of people hear this and they say, oh my God, this is socialism, this is communism, this is a slippery slope, all those nasty things. Absolutely not. I mean, we've had the New Deal experience where the government intervenes as a safety net in the job market, so that workers who are ready, willing, and able to work but can't find employment in the private sector, the government can hire them and employ them in useful, productive positions to not compete with the private sector, but to provide things that are either under-supplied by the private sector or things that are not supplied by the private sector at all, things that are not profitable for the private sector. And you're absolutely right. The green industry is the way to go, because no private sector industry today is willing to spend hundreds of millions and hundreds of billions of dollars to build infrastructure to reshift and regear the U.S. economy away from fossil fuels towards green technology. The only entity that can afford to do that is the federal government, not even state and local governments. There has to be funding that has to come from the federal government.
We have a caller, and the first for Fight Back, we have a caller by the name of Cutie.
Cutie, all right, our first Cutie, 821-1580. Hello, caller.
No, it's not Cutie. You know, it's Cutie. How are you guys doing?
Oh, we're doing well. Well, I know Judith. I think it's applicable. Okay.
You know, my sister passed away about 5 years ago. She was in her 70s. And I remember she and I had a discussion about Ronald Reagan. Well, everybody knows what happened with the air traffic controllers. But from the black perspective, my sister, who was very smart, he said that Ronald Reagan was one of the worst presidents that we ever had as far as from the black perspective. And then when I was thinking about our conversation with about Ronald Reagan and comparing him to Mitt Romney, it seems like it's kind of eerie, the things they have in common, and I wanted to get your guest opinion on that. And my second point that I would like to ask him, okay, you know, we understand what the unemployment rate is. Okay, so they're offering classes and to retrain people that are without jobs. Okay, that's fine and good, but then too, after they get out of the training, where are they going to work if the industries are not here to substantiate their new training? That doesn't make sense to me.
Professor Kabu.
Well, on the Reagan question, I completely agree, and I'm sorry I don't remember the exact incident, but there was, during the Reagan years, there was a prison riot, I think, in somewhere in New York. And recently we've discovered the phone conversations between Reagan and state officials and security officials, and we've heard his statements about essentially ordering an attack on the rioters in that prison. Most of them were African Americans, and we've heard his honest views and honest opinions about blacks and about prisoners. So I'm not going to comment more on that. I mean, his record speaks for itself.
What about the famous question of, he kicked off his campaign in Philadelphia, Mississippi, primarily known as the birthplace of the modern Klan, and he talked there repeatedly about, quote, states' rights, and he opposed the civil rights movement. Many feel that that was a coded message to the former Dixiecrats of the South, that if you go along with me, I will repeal a lot of these gains of the black population from the civil rights movement.
Right, and again, I'm not a political scientist, I'm not expert on these things, but I think his record speaks for itself.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as Mitt Romney goes, again, his own speeches tell us everything about where he's going to go if he's elected president. His comments about the 47%, about the poor, it doesn't need an explanation, it doesn't need kind of scientific analysis. That's where he comes from, that's what he believes in. It's unfortunate that, you know, that a lot of American citizens were listening to the debates and kind of saw his, you know, nice and clean statements the other night on the debate without going back and looking at his actual track record. On the other question on training for jobs, absolutely, I'm a true believer in on the job training, jobs first, training later. But the excuses that we keep hearing from the neoliberals is that all these people are unemployable. They don't have skills. Their skills are for the old industries. They have to retrain. They have to get some more education, some more skills. Those are excuses. And when you hear the word unemployable, pretty often that's a code word for women, minorities,
new immigrants
and people with, I'm sorry,
new immigrant groups.
New immigrant groups, and these are the people essentially in the U.S. economy. When you look at the business cycle, these are groups that tend to be the first to be fired when there is a recession, and the last to be hired when there is economic growth. And you look at that group of population; they tend to be women and minorities, and people with criminal records, people with mental health issues, homeless people, and that's not the right solution to say, oh, go get some training and then you'll be able to compete. We have to create jobs first and then do the training on the jobs.
On that note, we need to take a break. Al Gabel's on the phone, and we'll take his call when we come back from the break.
We'll be right back on Fight Back.
The fight has just begun. Fight Back with Dr. Bob Patricius is back after this short break.
have a truly special event coming up, make it unforgettable with a chauffeured limousine from Cardinal Transportation. Central Ohio's premier chauffeured transportation company, Cardinal Transportation provides personalized, affordable, and safe transportation both locally or out of town. Their fleet includes a 1960 Rolls Royce, 8-passenger limos, and buses for up to 56 passengers. Contact Cardinal Transportation today at 274-2500, 274-2500, or online at cardinaltrans.com, or visit them on Facebook at Cardinal Transportation.
You gotta fight for your right.
If you like to party, and who doesn't, you know that sometimes stuff happens. Stuff like assault, drugs, DUIs. Connie Goodell Newton understands. She's not here to judge anyone, just to provide the best legal representation possible. Facing criminal charges? Connie takes very special care handling her criminal cases and works hard to ensure that her clients receive the very best results possible. Do you have a record? Connie is very familiar with the new expanded expungement statute. Got warrants? Connie may be able to keep you out of jail. Connie also handles domestic relations, mediation, and bankruptcy cases. Call Connie Goodell Newton at 307-9783. Connie welcomes clients from diverse communities, GLBT, African-American, activists, students, and more. So party on. Just remember, if you get just one phone call, make it to Connie Goodell Newton at 307-9783.
This is Connie Goodell Newton, and I will fight for your right to party.
Meat Packers Outlet, Columbus's good old-fashioned retail meat market. For the best deals around on all your meat purchases, visit Meat Packers Outlet at 317 South 5th Street downtown. Meat Packers Outlet is family-owned and operated and has proudly been serving Columbus with fresh-cut meat since 1957. Meat Packers Outlet has daily low prices on beef, pork, poultry, and deli items. This week's specials include deli sliced honey ham, just $2.99 a pound. Bar S Wing is 99 cents for a 1-pound package. A 10-pound bag of fresh hamburgers is $19.90, and whole pork loins are $2.49 a pound. Need a deli tray for your next get-together? Call ahead and order yours now at 469-1720. That's 469-1720. Open 8 to 6, closed Sundays. Meat Packers Outlet, 317 South 5th Street at East Main, downtown. Don't forget, there's always plenty of free parking in the back. Locally owned, independently owned, Meat Packers Outlet. Call 469-1720.
How would you like to have your garage back? You know, so you can actually get your car inside? Why not make room by storing all that stuff you have in the garage at Morningstar Mini Storage at South High? Morningstar Mini Storage offers clean, safe, secure storage units in sizes up to 10 by 30. Or make Morningstar Mini Storage your garage. You can store your car for just $39 a month, or any size boat, RV, or trailer for just $49 a month. Or take advantage of their new special, a 5x15 or 10x10 unit for just $69 a month. Find their online coupons at MorningstarMiniStorage.com. Morningstar Mini Storage has convenient 24-hour access 7 days a week, a state-of-the-art security system, a moving van, and packing materials too. Morningstar Mini Storage, 3391 South High Street at Williams Road, just north of I-270. Call 497-0000 or visit them online at MorningstarMiniStorage.com. Morningstar Mini Storage is South High, 497-0000.
You get anxious just thinking about going to the dentist? The Dental Dentist in Worthington understands. Founded by Dr. Bill Coleman, the Dental Dentist is dedicated to the care of the apprehensive dental patient and is committed to providing the highest quality dental care in a relaxed and enjoyable environment. The Dental Dentist offers cable TV, DVD players, and massage chairs in every treatment room. They use the latest technology to give you that beautiful smile you deserve, including Invisalign, the virtually invisible way to straighten your teeth. The highest quality dental care in a relaxed and enjoyable environment. The Dental Dentist, voted the number one dental office in Central Ohio by Columbus Parents Magazine 2 years in a row. Visit them in Worthington, just south of 270. Call today, 614-431-3311, or visit them online at ColemanDental.com. That's ColemanDental.com. Call today, 614-431-3311. The Dental Dentist, exceptional service, remarkably gentle.
Yeah! Yeah!
He doesn't just play a doctor. Bob the Tracer is a doctor. Just not that kind of doctor. Factions fight back with political science professor Dr. Bob the Tracer.
This is Dr. Bob Tracus. I want to give time for Dr. Sahil Kabloub of Granville, of Denison University in Granville. Time to wrap up, but let's go first to the last caller on the line. Hello, caller. You got a question.
This is Al Gobble from Blue Dublin. I'd like to have Professor Bob and the guest professor respond to the following short statement. The Consumer Banking Bureau was very much fought by the Republicans who get donations for re-election from the banking industry. President Obama had to make a recess appointment and finance the Bureau with money he controlled. Rich Cord Reagan was quietly making great strides on these unfair practices. He was issuing many subpoenas, and I'd just like to have you comment on this effort.
Professor,
the Consumer Protection Board that was created by President Obama was a long overdue agency that needs the firepower of the federal government behind it, and unfortunately, President Obama, I fully support the operation of the new agency and its director and everything, but Elizabeth Warren was the woman, the Harvard law professor who was behind this whole thing for the last several years, deserved the nomination, and unfortunately she didn't get it because she would be the dog to fight essentially in Washington D.C. and on Wall Street. But she's running for office now in Massachusetts she's running for Senate, and I hope that she wins and I expect great things to come out of her her campaign and her taking over office in Washington, hopefully. On the agency's efforts, you're fighting a big beast. So if the federal government doesn't put its full weight behind this agency and really goes after some of the Wall Street criminals, it's going to be just a cosmetic change in Washington, D.C., that here we go, we have this agency that protects consumers, but when it comes to de facto action, it's just a little parasite on Wall Street, and Wall Street doesn't really worry about it. You have to keep in mind that Wall Street and corporations are more than happy to pay, you know, $500 million fines here and there, a couple billion dollars in terms of fines for pharmaceutical companies. That's nothing. That's peanuts. But if we don't go after fraudsters, if we don't go after Wall Street criminals and take them to court as individual criminals, we're not going to change anything in the financial system because corporations are more than happy to pay those fines.
Okay, we've only got about 5 minutes left. When I saw you speak, you said we actually could employ all or most of the unemployed, including the long term.
Right.
How would we do that?
It's very easy. I mean, funding from the federal government, you have tons and tons of local nonprofit organizations that are doing useful and productive work for the community. They know their community best. They know the resources they have, or the lack thereof, I should say, and they know the needs of the community. So it should be local community organizations, NGOs, who select projects, who, you know, apply for grants from the federal government and say, this is what we think our community needs, and these are the local unemployed individuals, and this is the kind of skills they have. We're going to try to match the skills they have, not train them and retrain them, but match the skills that they have with the needs of the community. And we're not going to recruit them as volunteers, which is what most nonprofit organizations do. We're going to recruit them as employees, and we want the federal government to pay for that. So the implementation, the selection, the supervising of the project, the assessment of the results of the projects will be done at the local level. Only the funding comes from the federal government. And this is the kind of new deal type of program. And what I'm proposing here, and the thing that you saw in my presentation the other day, if we do this for the 23 or 24 million people who are underemployed today, we employ them for full-time, 40 hours a week, plus the benefit package of $10,000 per employee for health benefits, retirement benefits, and so on. And if we estimate an annual material cost of $50 billion to run these programs nationwide, and this is a generous estimate, then the net total annual cost for this program will be less than $600 billion. And to the people who say, oh, we can't afford it, this is too expensive, let me remind you that we did. The first bailout stimulus package was almost $800 billion. The second was $800 billion, plus the trillions of dollars that the Federal Reserve Bank spent in the last 5 years to bail out the financial system. Trillions, with a T. So what I'm proposing here is a program that costs less than $600 billion to employ 24 million people. And I'm not talking about minimum wage jobs. These numbers are based on three types of wages. For skilled workers, $21 an hour. For semi-skilled workers, $18 an hour. And for unskilled workers, $15 an hour. So we're not talking, you know, poverty line wages. We're talking living wages. And you can adjust these upwards or downwards or whatever based on whatever society decides. The point is, this is not expensive. This is affordable. We can do it. It's just we've decided to go the neoliberal way. All of those bailout packages that we've seen have gone to the financial institutions who are now sitting on trillions of dollars, but they're not willing to lend. And we've gone the indirect way, trying to incentivize corporations to hire people by giving them tax breaks instead of workers gainful employment with a decent living wage.
All right, we're out of time here. Thanks a lot, Professor Kabig. We're going to have you back on because we believe in fighting back here at WVKO. What's so funny about peace, love, understanding, and full employment?
The Good Fight continues with Dr. Bob next Saturday at 11 a.m. Get your friends and family to join the fight right here on the air or over the internet at WVKO1580.com. Fight Back is produced in part by the Columbus Free Press and 1580 WVKO.
Your one true voice of reason in Central Ohio, AM 1580, WDKO, Columbus.
You gotta fight for your rights!
If you like to party, and who doesn't, you know that sometimes stuff happens. Stuff like assault, drugs, DUIs. Connie Goodell Newton understands. She's not here to judge anyone, just to provide the best legal representation possible. Facing criminal charges? Connie takes very special care handling her criminal cases and works hard to ensure that her clients receive the very best results possible. Do you have a record? Connie is very familiar with the new expanded expungement statute. Got warrants? Connie may be able to keep you out of jail. Connie also handles domestic relations, mediation, and bankruptcy cases. Call Connie Goodell Newton at 307-9783. Connie welcomes clients from diverse communities, GLBT, African-American, activists, students, and more. So party on. Just remember, if you get this one phone call, they